And Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman, it is today's Topical Currents, Tuesday edition. And this hour, we visit with Florida State University history professor and prolific author Darren McMahon. His latest work is a fascinating examination of lofty and brilliant human contributions. It's called Divine Fury, A History of Genius. And Darren McMahon joins us from Tallahassee. Welcome to you, Darren.
Thank you, Joseph. It's great to be with you.
Well, great to have you here. You know, this is so fascinating to think that as our cultural needs change, so do our needs for geniuses. And I know I'm jumping the gun, but what do we attribute to having a genius bar replete with geniuses at every Apple store? What's going on in our culture that we have so many geniuses?
It's a great question, Bonnie. And, you know, one of the things I trace in the book is a sort of long-running tension between the genius as great exception and a kind of democratic need to be equal or to be all alike. And I think that tension plays out particularly strongly in America. And what we're witnessing today is, you know, something along these lines. We like exceptional individuals, and yet we all want to believe that on some level we can be exceptional, too. We all can be geniuses, and there's a whole self-help literature out there right now that says just that. You too can think like Leonardo, and I can be a genius. And if you can't quite be one yourself, at least you can meet one, as you say, at the Genius Bar at the Apple Store, or maybe next door. You probably have a friend who's a genius, right?
Darren, I liked your disclaimer near the end of the book that you by no means consider yourself a genius, and you bungle with computers and kind of sometimes just kind of schlep around.
You know, if that idea entered my head, my wife and children would beat it out very quickly. And I think my parents did a pretty good job of foreclosing the possibility from very early on. No, I'm certainly not a genius and make no claim to that.
Well, Bonnie and I are probably on the same level. Well, maybe I should just speak for myself.
Well, speak for yourself. That's right. Well, no, I'd like to know, because whenever, you know, people always... you hear of people having this genius IQ. So to have a genius IQ, does that mean you're a genius?
Well, you know, in fact, the IQ exam, when it originates in the early part of the 20th century, is immediately used to sort of try to ascertain just this. Actually, ironically, the IQ exam is designed to gauge originally mental retardation, but very quickly people see that it can be used on the other end of the scale as well. And in fact, the search for an intelligence quotient, the IQ, grows out of a sort of long-standing search from the 18th century forward to try to isolate, identify, and quantify genius. I think, though, that what people have discovered over the course of the 20th century is that IQ and genius are not necessarily the same thing. You need to have some smarts, to be sure, but too high an IQ actually might not be optimal for creativity and invention and originality, which are also important parts of genius.
Well, should we go back to the beginning? I guess it's the 2nd century BC in Rome, where the word genius can be traced back to. Is that correct?
Absolutely. In fact, that's our first kind of written record of it. It's probably an older concept than that. One of the main points I make in the book is that our notion of genius as a special individual of, you know, great intelligence and creative power is a relatively recent notion, but we've used the term for an awful long time. The term, as you suggest, is a Roman one. The Latin word genius, which is spelled just like our genius, but probably pronounced in Latin genius, was a different idea, though. The Romans had a belief that all males had a kind of tutelary spirit or guardian angel that watched over them from birth until death and acted as an intercessor to the gods. So one's genius or genie in the plural sort of shuttled back and forth between the sacred world, the realm of the gods, and the profane world, the world of daily life, and they brought petitions to the gods, and they relayed divine knowledge and information to individuals.
you said all men, but you're not saying it in the generic form. You're saying just men?
That's correct. And, you know, one of the sort of unfortunate things about the history of genius is it has this kind of male prejudice built in from very early on. That's a theme that I take up at some length in the book. The Roman idea was that only men had this tutelary spirit. Now, women had a different kind of guardian, but the male guardian, the genius, was specific just to men. And in fact, you get a little bit of that sense even in the word itself. The word genius derives from a Latin root genogenere, which meant to father or to beget, to sort of impregnate.
As in Genesis, biblically.
As in Genesis, yes, exactly, or later in genes or even genitals. So there's a kind of relationship between the word genius and indeed the concept later on, and an emphasis on sort of male procreative power. Now, I like to point out that women don't take this lightly, and there are challenges to this notion all the way along. But the way that the idea of genius takes shape, at least in the modern period, there's a kind of male bias built into it.
Is genius necessarily linked to eccentricities and human failings? While I was reading your book, it made me think about the chess champion Bobby Fischer.
Yeah, and of course there are all kinds of examples that one can cite this way, and it turns out that at least thinking about genius in connection to madness is a very, very old way of thinking. The title of my book, Divine Fury, comes from a line of Plato, the great Greek philosopher Plato, who spoke of what he referred to as divine furor or divine mania, which was when the gods breathed into you. They blew their breath into you and filled you up with a kind of ecstasy that would allow prophets to prophesy or poets to create great works of art. But what Plato says as well is that also is a kind of madness. It's as if you're possessed by an alien force that takes you over and allows you to do these extraordinary things, but makes you a little strange in the process. There's also an ancient medical idea related to the theory of the humors. We still use some of these terms. We talk about people as being choleric or sanguine, and this refers to an older ancient idea that all human beings were made up of four principal bodily humors, various kinds of bile and so forth, and that those people who had a superabundance of black bile, melon ochre, were more likely to be eminent. In other words, Aristotle and some early theorists believe that that those prone to kind of mental instability have a greater likelihood of also being creative or being eminent in the arts or in statecraft or in other functions. So that idea is very old, and it gets revived at numerous periods into the modern period. And there's a whole medical science that develops in the 19th century to point out the relationship between madness and genius, or genius and criminality, and so it's an old conception.
Or genius and melancholia,
well,
which
exactly.
was a big thing that artists, suffered from melancholia.
Exactly,
guess they used to call
a kind of depression, and melancholia literally means from the root a kind of black bile, a superabundance of black bile. Yes, and so that ancient idea gets revived, in fact, during the Renaissance. And you get, this sort of appreciation for sadness as a sign of artistic suffering or artistic.
Exactly.
Yeah, and that's that's, I think, in some ways still with us. I like to point out that, in more cases than not, I think this is this kind of legend that there is no necessary association between genius and mental instability, although it depends on the field. But in many fields, I think this is more of a kind of myth than a reality.
So going back to ancient times, was it thought that one was possessed by genius rather than one possessed genius?
So there are two different notions. There's the one that I just referred to that Plato picks up on and in some ways mocks, the idea that you are possessed by an alien force.
Right.
Possessed by a genius. Your genius is a guardian spirit, a kind of angel. And if that, people with a particularly strong genius are taken over by that genius, they too can have very strong powers. But there's also the idea that that great poets and prophets and statesmen have something themselves. something that sets them apart from ordinary individuals, something that can't be learned or acquired, but that is there inherently. The Romans called this ingenium. Ingenium actually is a kind of variant of the term genius. It literally means the kind of genius in us. But they see it as almost as biological or physiological. It's inherent in the person. And it sets them apart, right? But to specify beyond that becomes a little difficult. It's that special something, that X factor that that sets these individuals apart. The great Roman statesman Cicero calls it the quidem divinum, the something divine that that great individuals have.
Well, when did divinity become part of this? I guess I'm thinking more about religion now, but was divinity part of it before?
Well, I think in many ways, and what I try to argue in the book, is that notions of genius are tied up with notions of divinity from the very beginning. So in this Roman conception, a genius, a genius, is literally a kind of god or spirit that attends one. And as I say, those with a stronger genius are stronger for it. That idea gets Christianized in interesting ways. Now, there is a long Jewish and other pagan speculation about angels, but it's fairly clear that what early Christians do is take over this Roman cult of the genius and replace it with notions of patron saints or guardian angels. And so well into the early modern period, get a continued speculation that those people of particular brilliance, particular insight, who are able to kind of see where others can't, have themselves special access to the divine via a guardian saint, via a guardian angel, that they're privileged people. They're touched by God with this kind of divine and special authority.
We're speaking with Professor Darren McMahon. He's the Ben Weider Professor of History at Florida State University and an author. His latest book is Divine Fury, A History of Genius, on today's Topical Currents. A short break, and we'll be right back. Today's Topical Currents, speaking of genius.
That gives you chills.
Yes, it does. Professor Darren McMahon, his book, Divine Fury, A History of Genius. So, a little Beethoven. Was Beethoven known as here he was, completely deaf, writing the Ninth Symphony? That, of course, the Choral Symphony. Was he known as a genius in his time?
Very much so. And so I try to argue in the book that the modern cult of genius originates in the 18th century for reasons that we can get into. But by Beethoven's time in the early 19th century, the cult of genius is very much alive. You know, people like Napoleon before him, but also Mozart and others have been hailed as geniuses. And Beethoven sort of embodies that role, and he seems to fit the part perfectly. Not only does he have the goods to back it up, because, you know, in order to pass yourself off as a genius, you have to be able to kind of talk the talk, but he has a kind of look, right? The wild hair and the eccentricities, the deafness, sense that he's carrying the weight of the world on his shoulders. And so he very much does embody and sort of live this new cultural icon.
Well, why don't we look at some of the factors? I mean, we can go still back further if you want, and, you know, before the 18th century. But what was going on during the 18th century that opened the door for this modern notion of genius?
So scholars and historians have known for a long time that the cult of genius originates in the 18th century. But to my mind, they haven't really pushed the question as to why far enough. And so that's the critical question I try to take up. And what I try to argue is that one of the things that happens in the 18th century is people have a sense that the spirits sort of authorities who had long mediated between ordinary human life and the divine, I'm talking about saints and prophets angels, demonic figures of one sort or another, there's an increasing willingness to discount the existence of these creatures. There's also a belief in the 18th century that God, while not entirely absent from the universe, although there are those who begin to entertain that speculation, while not entirely absent, is nonetheless somewhat less present on a day-to-day level, that God may not sort of take an active interest in our daily affairs. Philosophers talk about God withdrawing or receding in this period. And what I want to argue is that the modern genius emerges to sort of fill that space in between the sacred and the profane, taking on certain godlike powers and taking on certain of the powers and functions that these religious mediating figures had served for centuries. So modern geniuses become prophets of sorts. They become privileged beings who can see into the fabric of creation, see into our souls. They themselves create. They bring new ideas into the world. They reveal. They do things that, as I say, the religious figures of old had done. You see this very early with one of the first examples of genius in the modern cult, Newton, who is hailed as a genius and is very astute at embodying that role. But you also see it vis-a-vis some of the great musicians that arise in the 18th century. The word genius is applied to poets and writers like Goethe, or people like Benjamin Franklin even. And then at the very end of the century, as I suggested before, to Napoleon, who's really a critical figure in my story because he's one of the first to realize that there's a sort of political value to presenting oneself and being received as a genius.
You use the term sacred and profane. I see that associated with Mozart quite a bit. I remember reading a music historian saying that his 20th piano concerto was Mozart's Race to the Gods.
That's wonderful. Yeah. Well, and there's no question that the young Mozart is treated as a prodigy. Now, of course, a prodigy is somebody who can play the piano well at a young age, but the word prodigy, and still very much in the 18th century, had a religious connotation of a kind of marvel, right? A miraculous thing that is difficult to explain. And people who saw Mozart as a child responded to him this way. You know, there was something marvelous about what he did, something not quite human. It's as if their only way to explain it was with recourse to the divine.
So going to Beethoven or Mozart, or let's stick with Beethoven just for a moment because it's to the 18th century or 19th century, but getting, you know, going ahead, these special privileges, these powers that they had, were they not thought to be a function of God as the creator, that God created and so that they were just channeling God?
There's still, of course, very many people in the 18th and 19th century who believe that, as there are today. And yet, people are placing less emphasis on the direct divine characteristics of geniuses and increasingly emphasizing that geniuses have something special by birth. This is a point that's really driven home in the 18th century when people start to study geniuses. Because at the same time as the cult of genius emerges, people begin to ask, what is it and how do we detect it? And the dominant notion of genius that emerges from the 18th century and continues very much into the 19th century is the idea that genius is born, not made. You can learn how to be a talented pianist, but you can't learn how to be a genius. You either have it or you don't. It's there to begin with. And so that puts an emphasis on the kind of natural characteristics of genius. And yet, as I try to suggest, and I think as you're hinting at here, people continue to use this older religious language to discuss geniuses, and they freight geniuses, if you will, with somewhat divine powers, right? Geniuses are people who can do what ordinary mortals can't. And so even if they're not specific references to theology or to divine constructions, they're still thought to be in possession of marvelous and fantastic abilities that make them unlike ordinary human beings.
What about the idiot savant?
Well, you know, one of the things that's interesting, you know, I mentioned Plato before, and Plato, when he talks about divine mania, does so in some ways invidiously. You probably know that in Plato's Republic, he famously wanted to banish the poets from the Republic,
right,
his perfect society. And in part, he wanted to do that because he realized their power. Poets are wordsmiths. They're people who are able to bend language and seduce as a consequence. They're able with their tongues. And Plato saw that as a dangerous power because it appealed directly to our emotions.
But that's so ironic, just to don't interrupt for a second, but
no, sure.
Because Socrates was known for the power of his words through Plato.
Well, exactly. And of course, but on the other hand, Plato knew what happened to Socrates.
That's true.
He was, put to death, forced to drink hemlock, in part because of his genius. And indeed, one of the direct charges against Socrates was that he had a strange god, a daimon, which is the Greek equivalent of this Latin idea of a genius. He had his own private spirit that spoke to him. And this was destabilizing and troublesome. Socrates was seen as a kind of rebel. And Socrates is another figure who enters into the story repeatedly. But Plato then realizes there's a kind of there's a link to madness in poetic ability. There's a danger associated with it. But he also speaks of it, as I say, invidiously, because if a great poet is filled up by a divine spirit, if a great poet is possessed by the divine, it implies that that person doesn't have anything original to begin with. And this is sort of the way that Plato talks about poets, that they are empty vessels that are filled by the gods or gods. And that opens the way for thinking, as you say, of a kind of idiot savant, somebody who has this power poured into him but doesn't possess anything to begin with.
Why don't we give out our telephone number? I'm sure we'd have some callers who'd like to
geniuses
ask
or not, you can call.
Comment. Our number 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Also email radio@WLRN.org. Please keep those emails short if possible.
Or you can tweet us at Topical Currents. Well, should we move to the 20th century? There's a lot in between, but one of the things you said was that the religion of genius, which you say started in the 18th century, was a precondition of Hitler's acceptance. So what do you mean by that? Was Hitler, except among Germans, or was it only among Germans that he was known as a genius?
Right. So let's back up just a little bit, because I think there are some groundwork that needs to be laid.
Okay.
And I'm going to go back to Napoleon just for a second, and then we'll move forward, because you're absolutely right. There's an important link between this cult of genius or this religion of genius that begins to develop in the 18th century, and strange as that sounds to modern ears, and as perverse as it sounds to modern ears, a link between that and Adolf Hitler. But there are some steps along the way. And Napoleon is interesting in this respect. If you think about it, who is Napoleon? You know, he's kind of a thug from the provinces, right? He's a minor noble, but he's from Corsica. He's not really anyone of stature in French society. And yet he becomes emperor of the strongest and most cultured country in Europe, and is able to kind of cow great heads of state in staterooms across Europe, great heads of state who are themselves heir to long lineage, dynastic lineage, and so forth. Napoleon doesn't have that. He's not a royal. He's not from a great aristocratic family. He doesn't even have, strictly speaking, democratic mandate. What does he have? Well, he has genius. And he uses this very self-consciously from quite early on. Already when he's in Italy in the 1790s, he has his newspaper present him in propaganda as a genius who's able to do things that ordinary human beings are not. Again, Napoleon's somebody who has the goods to carry that off. But he recognizes that genius becomes a kind of a way of legitimating his rule. And so on the back of the cult of genius that develops in the 18th century, he uses that very self-consciously in propaganda throughout his reign to enhance the mystique and character of his power. Hitler saw that precedent. Hitler also was an artist originally and an architect, and steeped in a kind of tradition of what the Germans call Geniegedanke, or genius thought, in the 19th century that develops in Germany even more strongly than it does in England, say, or France, or the United States. And very self-consciously, he uses that genius thought in his own propaganda, presenting himself, again, as impl- plausible as that seems to us today, as a genius with the accompanying religious dynamic that that entailed, a genius who could be a prophet for his people, a genius who could save and redeem the German people. Hitler writes about genius at some length in Mein Kampf. He goes out of his way in his early career to have himself associated with people who were associated in Germany with genius, the tradition of Richard Wagner, the great composer, is the best example of this. And then when he comes to power in 1933, he presents himself in the guise of genius very self-consciously in his propaganda, and people bought it.
Can Hitler. We just put a period there, because we want to stay on Hitler, because it's really interesting. It's an interesting part of your book. But we need to take a break on today's topical currents. We're speaking with Professor Darren McMahon of Florida State University. The book is Divine Fury, A History of Genius. Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Professor Darren McMahon of FSU. His latest book is Divine Fury, A History of Genius. And when we took our break, we were talking about Hitler and how he used genius in order to advance himself. So do you want to continue? Do you remember where you were?
I do, and thanks for cutting me off. You know, every professor should have somebody put periods at the end of their sentence. I'm sure many of my students are jealous. Talking about Hitler and the way he self-consciously uses and presents himself as a genius and uses the cult of genius extant then in Germany to enhance his power, he also comes on the back not only of this whole thinking of genius in the 19th century and a kind of self-conscious mythology of geniuses, which is akin to a religion. In fact, contemporary commentators are calling this genius religion. But he also comes on the back of a whole self-conscious science that develops in the 19th century that I call genealogy, D-E-N-I-O-L-O-G-Y, that begins in the 18th century with people trying to figure out how you detect genius. One of the first things they do is to try to find it in the face. And in fact, physiognomy, the science of the study of face, develops in part to identify genius. You get in the 19th century the study of skulls and then brains to try to ascertain genius. And you also get, as I say, at the very end of the century, the IQ. But the other thing that happens in the 19th century is that people start to speculate about the relationship between genius and heredity, or genius and race. And in this respect, too, there's quite a kind of dark side to the history of genius. Mm-hmm. And one of the critical people here is Francis Galton, who is the father of eugenics. He's the cousin of Charles Darwin, but he's also a great student of genius. And in fact, his first book is called Hereditary Genius, and it tries to figure out and argue that genius runs in hereditary lines. So Hitler is able to kind of piggyback on this pseudoscience in the 19th century, including on a psychological science that associates genius and madness, genius and rashness. So the very fact that Hitler would kind of, you know, foam at the mouth when he spoke, when he ranted and raved, actually enhanced in some ways his genius-like air, at least in the eyes of many of his followers. The very fact, too, that he was a failure in the first part of his career enhanced this mystique. So, you know, there's an idea that geniuses are so far ahead of their time. Y'all still there?
Yeah, I think someone's ringing in on your phone.
I'm sorry.
No, that's
There's an idea that geniuses are so far ahead of their time that they won't be understood initially by their contemporaries. So the very fact that Hitler is a kind of rejected as an artist or as an architect, strange as this may sound, actually feeds into the genius myth that he was so far ahead of his time that he's only appreciated later in his career.
Well, where did the Jews come into it? Because he would call them an inferior race, and yet they had advanced in every area.
Very much so, and of course, the good genius in my book to the evil genius Hitler is Albert Einstein, who comes into his own in this very same period and is seen by Hitler and the Nazis as a kind of direct threat to the mythology of genius that they're perpetuating. But Jews in general are seen as a threat, in part because, you know, they're winning Nobel Prizes right, left, and center.
Right.
They're scoring off the charts on aptitude tests and IQ tests in ways that sort of astound people like Galton, who is himself an anti-Semite, and other early students of genius. And so for Hitler and others, the Jews are a problem. And the way this is presented is that Jews are talented, but this goes back to this 18th century distinction between genius and talent, and it's always an invidious one. Jews are maybe talented, but they imitate, they copy, and hence steal original creative ideas from the great German creators. And in so doing, they sap the power, the creative power of the German folk, the German people. And the other thing that's going on with all this that I think is really interesting is that from the 18th century forward, you get the idea that geniuses can somehow embody or speak for the genius of the people. You may have heard that Latin phrase, the genius populi. It goes all the way back to the Romans again. The idea that there's a kind of governing spirit of a people. So Shakespeare is presented really for the first time in the 18th century as a genius, even though he's much older, of course, and people had thought of him for some time as a great playwright. He's only presented as a genius in the 18th century who, although he's unlike any other individual, somehow embodies Englishness, right? Goethe becomes this sort of figure for Germany early on, Benjamin Franklin in some ways for the United States or later Edison, and Hitler presents himself in that way too as the spokesperson for the German people who will redeem them, who will revive their creative capacity. In order to do that, one must get rid of the Jews who are preventing the Germans from coming into the fullness of their creative power.
Let's take a telephone call or two. We've got Dwight. He's in Pembroke Pines. Thanks for your patience, Dwight. Hi.
Hi. Thanks. Thanks for taking my call. I'm just curious on how your speaker thinks that history is going to revere genius in this age of communication, or the information age, I guess, is what we're going to call it a couple hundred years from now, wherein the genius thought has to be. It's like overbearing with all this counter talk from individuals who now have the ability to speak almost directly to geniuses on their thought, you know, where it's almost like the geniuses are doing battle with all this idiocracy, you know, to borrow a word, you know, that has kind of just come into our language recently. You know, you could take climate change where you have arguably all the greatest geniuses in the world taking a look at this, and then, you know, it almost seems like they have twice the hill to climb. You know, how are we going to look at this 2,000 years from now when, you know, like the earth was flat at one point, you know, and those people were burned or hanged, you know, for this kind of heresy?
Professor, do you have a comment?
Well, it's awfully complicated. And one of the things that I try to argue in the book is that, as strange as this may sound, because we use the term genius all the time now, that the cult of the genius is really dead, that the cult of the genius in some ways dies with Einstein, who is the last great figure, the last good genius, who is considered in terms of the religion or cult of genius that develops from the 18th century. Einstein, the man who wants to understand how God thinks. Einstein, who literally sees into the space and time continuum of the universe. Einstein, at least in the popular mythology, who sort of unlocks the secret of atomic energy with its terrible and also redemptive explosive capacities. But Einstein is really the last genius that large numbers of people all can kind of agree on. Today, we've democratized the idea. And there are lots of geniuses, you know, sort of lowercase g, but it's difficult in the midst of all these geniuses to point to people today and say, he's a genius or she's a genius. You know, we talk about Bill Gates and Steve Jobs and some others in these terms.
What about Stephen Hawking?
Well, you know, Hawking is an interesting case. He is, and I think he's certainly been presented that way in the media. And in some ways, again, he fits the part. He's a kind of sage-like, his physical incapacity somehow enhances his mental capacity, so he's almost a pure mind, again, who sees into the continuum of the universe. And so there are certainly figures like this. But I'm not sure that they're widely shared, and they're not accorded the kind of power that the geniuses of old were accorded in keeping with this, what I call religion of genius, or this cult of the great individual. And just to finish the thought in answer to your caller's question or comment, I think that one of the things that people have understood from the 18th century, Einstein himself understood this, certainly Steve Jobs and Bill Gates understand this, is that any great achiever borrows necessarily from the network that your caller referred to, the network that ties all kinds of people together. Jobs was fond of quoting a line from Picasso, attributed to Picasso, that good artists copy and great artists steal. What was Jobs really good at? He was really good at taking other people's ideas and tweaking them in really interesting and creative ways and making them available then to large numbers of people. But that work is predicated on networks of people working for them. And so my point is that the idea, the myth that individual creators do all on their own, I think is a myth that in some ways can't withstand the pressure of the late 20th and early 21st century.
We're speaking with Professor Darren McMahon from Florida State University. His latest book is Divine Fury, A History of Genius. One more short break on Topical Currents, and we'll return.
And it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Our subject this hour is genius. We're speaking with Florida State University professor and author Darren McMahon. He's written Divine Fury, A History of Genius. We'll have links to Professor McMahon and also the book on the Topical Currents Facebook page if you'd like to check that out. Laura in Coral Gables, hi there. Laura, you're up.
Hello. I just wanted to present to you that if you read Malcolm Gladwell's book, Outliers, he will outline for you that there really is nothing such as a genius, that if you look carefully at that person's background, you will see things that you can come to understand contributed to his or her being outstanding in a specific field. His concept of the 10,000 hours is part of that postulate, and he also delineates accidents of timing of birth insofar as there are certain things such as hockey players who have cutoffs of birth dates, and those that are born early in the year end up being the more outstanding hockey players. He shows that Bill Gates spent his time as a youth sneaking out of his house and going down to a local university to use their computer, which was free and open from 10 o'clock at night until 6 o'clock in the morning.
Professor, are you aware of this?
Absolutely. And, you know, the first thing I want to do is credit the work of my colleague here at Florida State, Anders Ericsson, who is a world-class psychologist in a world-class psychology department. Malcolm Gladwell is actually drawing, and of course he attributes this, on Anders' work. Anders studies great achievement. And what Anders wants to argue is, just as the caller said, great achievement is really more of a function of practice than inherent ability. And so this 10,000-hour rule that the caller referred to, is Anders says, that greatness in any field is going to require at a very minimum about 10,000 hours.
I think we had Anders on.
In training. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, he speaks a lot on this subject, and he's very convincing. And so he'll point out, for example, that somebody like Mozart, whom we want to assume is a kind of special rarefied individual in keeping with the myth of genius, actually had a father who was a music teacher and was playing from very early on and so forth. And you can apply this in lots of cases. I think there's something very compelling about that research. I also like to point out, as a historian, that people begin to make that case in the 18th century. In fact, there's a whole debate in the 18th century about what genius is, and there's a school of thought in the 18th century that says that genius is a function of timing, of exposure, of practice, and so forth. And yet that school of thought in the 18th century gets defeated. It gets defeated for reasons that I've discussed in the book, and replaced by this myth of genius, that genius is something, it's a quality that inheres in the person, that you can find it if you dissect Einstein's brain, that you can isolate it in an IQ test. It's a quality, it's a thing. That is, I think, as the caller suggests, largely a myth. And it becomes interesting to ask why it is that we're so invested in that myth. What is it that makes us want to attribute special powers to special individuals? And I have a whole set of theories on that, but I'll leave time for some from more callers.
Well, we'd rather hear, tell us, why are we so, you know, obsessed with this, having these geniuses?
Well, I think there are a number of things going on. One, I think there's a kind of psychological component in that ascribing genius to others as a natural, inherent thing, in a way, gets us off the hook, right? if that person's just born a genius, well, then there's nothing you can really do about it, mm-hmm. right, yourself. And so that's a kind of get-out-of-jail-free card, or gets you off the hook. In the structure of families, on a lower level, it works the same way. All parents know that there's a limited amount of time and resources that you can devote to any of your children. And if you single out one child as somehow gifted or special, it justifies the increased attention and time that you might spend with him or her. I also think then on a wider level, and my book in some ways is in engagement with this whole question, that there is a human need to marvel, even to prostrate ourselves before others. And that human need, that human desire to raise up idols is in tension, as I say, with a notion of democracy and equality. And the tension between these two becomes a really interesting theme to follow right down to the present day.
Well, do you think that because of the nature of our founding, the America, that we have a more of a need for this than other, you know, speaking of other world citizens, do Americans have more of a need, do you think, than others?
Well, we do and we don't. It's yes and no. I like to point out that, you know, when Thomas Jefferson says in the Declaration of Independence that all men are created equal, he doesn't really mean it. We know, of course, that he's not including women and Native Americans and African Americans and other disenfranchised groups. But he also doesn't actually believe that people are constitutionally equal. Maybe they should be accorded equal rights, but individuals are not the same. And indeed, Jefferson and others in 18th century America begin to think about this really seriously because they see an older world of blood aristocracy, of divine right kingship, a kind of hierarchy based upon tradition and aristocracy being replaced in the modern world. And yet they still see some need for hierarchy. What do you replace it with? One of the things that Jefferson suggests is genius or intelligence. And so intelligence becomes a criteria to justify inequality or to justify difference. Mm. And so in some ways, in a democratic culture that's getting rid of an older notions of hierarchy, intelligence or genius becomes more important. On the other hand, that notion is very much in tension with an American democratic ethos that said we're all created equal, and if we're not, we ought to be treated as if we are so, and that your merit and your striving and your hard work is really what ought to distinguish you from the next man or the next woman.
Bonnie, you have an email.
Yeah,
we're also very short on time.
Right. Martin just wants to know how you consider the new distinctions of intelligence, such as emotional intelligence or somatic intelligence, and how does that fall into the idea of genius?
Very much so, and it's an excellent question. I see the pluralization of intelligence as part of this broader democratization of genius. I happen to agree with Howard Gardner, who was the Harvard psychologist who developed the notion of multiple intelligence. There's Goleman's notion of emotional intelligence. And the idea here is that intelligence is not a single unitary thing. That's the kind of dominant assumption behind the IQ exams, that there's a certain kind of intelligence that correlates with different abilities, mathematical skill, musical ability, verbal ability, and so forth. And what people in multiple intelligence say is that actually mathematical reasoning and ability to read people are different things. I think we're much quicker today to recognize that there are different capacities and different skills, different kinds of intelligence, and that's in keeping with a belief that we have today that everyone has something special, everyone has a gift, everyone has a kind of genius. There's a little genius in all of us, which is the title, in fact, of a recent best-selling book.
Very little in this case.
Well, I was actually going to ask you about that, if everyone has a genius. Well, it's been really it's a fascinating book and a fascinating hour with Professor Darren McMahon. He's the Ben Weider Professor of History at Florida State University, an eminent historian, author, and speaker. You seem to really know your ancient history, too, don't you?
You know, when I live my next life, I'm going to become a classicist. I missed my calling.
But yeah.
I do it, you know, as a layperson.
Well, his latest book is Divine Fury, A History of Genius. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Bonnie. Thank you, Joseph. Mm-hmm.
And apologies to the callers we couldn't get on here. And thank you for listening. Topical Currents is produced by Richard Ives. Technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. Tomorrow's program looks at the Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman case with Today Show and NBC News legal analyst Lisa Bloom. She's written the book Suspicion Nation. She covered every minute of the trial. We have free audio archives and downloads at WLRN.org. Also information and links at the DC Facebook page. Topical Currents. And the calendar. On this day in 1793, 221 years ago, President George Washington's second inaugural speech at Philadelphia, the shortest address by any president, 133 refreshing words. And on this day in 1841, 174 years ago, the inaugural of William Henry Harrison in Washington. His speech, the longest, a deluge of 8,443 words. During a snowstorm, a month later, he died from pneumonia. And one more while we finally recall the slimy Johnny LaRue on SCTV. On this day in 1994, 20 years ago, the death of comedian John Candy of a heart attack in Durango, Mexico, age 43. 1941, the Blues Brothers, Stripes, Spaceballs, Uncle Buck, and of course, Home Alone. So we leave with a line from John Candy's Uncle Buck to his rebellious, snotty niece, quote, "How would you like to spend the next several nights wondering if your crazy, out-of-work bum, Uncle Buck, will shave your head while you sleep? See you in the car." See you next time. Bonnie Berman, Joseph Cooper, thanks for listening. Next up, it's Here and Now from NPR News.